Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Today is May Day. There are Occupy demonstrations going on across the country, as well as here in Baltimore, Maryland, Washington, D.C., and all over. It's May Day, which is a holiday that celebrates something that actually happened here in America that we don't really kind of think about because it's not something we put in our history books, which was the Haymarket, what they call riot, when the Chicago Police Department, killed and shot workers who were on strike in Chicago. And we'll talk a bit about that in that piece of our history as well. And one of the pieces I like to throw out here, because we forget this, there's a woman who was an integral part of that, who fought for the rights of human beings from before that and on. And she was a former slave. And she was married to one of the men, Albert Parsons, who was gunned down in 1871 in the Haymarket riots, which is where May 1st, Labor Day, came from. But she was a slave. She was a woman from Texas. He was a Confederate soldier from Texas. And she was a woman of black, Native American, and Mexican heritage who was a slave and married a man who was a Confederate soldier. They went to Chicago and became part of the labor movement, fighting for the human rights in that city. And she was an integral part of that. We'll talk a bit about that as well, because sometimes her voice and name gets lost in this. And we always think of these movements as being movements that just have to do with white America, which is just the opposite of reality. And so we're going to talk about all that and more in the course of this hour. We're joined once again, comes at least once a month, to bring his wit and wisdom to the airwaves, Dr. Lester Spence, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University and author of the book Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Power, Black Politics. Black Politics? Don't shoot me, Lester. I said Black Politics. I'm just waiting for the sequel to come out. You know, that's not the academic book, right?
There you go.
That's what we're waiting for. And Sarah Van Gelder is with us once again. Pleasure to have her with us, executive editor of Yes Magazine. And Sarah, welcome back. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages at Mark Steiner or The Mark Steiner Show and let us know what you're thinking. Some people have had thumbs up, but not many comments today, so let's get some comments. I like the thumbs up, but I'm going to get some comments as well. 410-319-8888. So, Sarah, let me start. I mean, just reflections on what this May Day means.
Well, I think it's a really interesting time, a historic time, when people in the United States are reclaiming a holiday that while it started in the United States, it's really being celebrated mostly in other countries. It's a national holiday in 80 other countries. But here in the United States, this is, you know, in addition to the Immigrant Rights March in 2006, this is really the first time that a lot of different people from the workers' movement, from the immigrant rights movement, from Occupy have all come together and said, you know, we're reclaiming this day. This is about the 99%.
And Lester, I know that I met your dad. Mm-hmm. I like him a great deal.
Yeah.
Auto worker. You grew up in a pretty revolutionary union household. So,
yeah, but it's interesting because I didn't know about this holiday,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think for those of you who are unaware. Well, we all know there was a moment in time in which the 8-hour work day, you know, the 40-hour work week was something that, you know, that wasn't that people didn't do, that wasn't given. But what we don't know is actually how people fought, how people had to fight to take that. So that's kind of what May Day is about. And I think that given the economic crisis that we're still kind of in the middle of, it's really appropriate that we reclaim this day and use it to take our labor back and rethink of all and to think about alternative uses, right? So, for example, there's a group of people, I think they're in New York, who are having like a free university day. So they're just basically teaching classes outside the university setting in the open air. So they're reusing they're taking their labor. They're not staying home. They're just reusing it or redeploying it in order to create kind of another world or show that another way of living is possible.
Sarah, I a lot of people talk about the Occupy movement and that kind of exploded onto the scene last year. And we did a lot to cover that during the course of when that was going on in New York and elsewhere. And people thought it would just fizzle out and die over the winter. But so talk about where you think that is now and what's been going on, as far as you know, today.
Well, you know, the Occupy movement is really about the question of what happens to the 99%. And over the last couple of decades, what we've seen is an erosion of the ability of people to build any kind of sense of economic security. You know, while productivity was going up enormously, all the benefits of that productivity increase was going to the CEOs and the Wall Street investors, and ordinary working people just were seeing their wages stagnate and having a harder and harder time getting by, and people made up for it by working more and more hours and having more and more people in the household, you know, at work in order to make ends meet, and then they borrowed against their home if they could or gotten the credit card debt. And with the 2008 crash, you know, we couldn't do those things anymore. So I think one of the things the Occupy Wall Street movement is all about is saying, you know, the middle class way of life is slipping out of reach, and for those of us who never did achieve it, it's slipping further out of the realm of possibility. And I think that kind of situation is one that people are just not going to tolerate. And whether it's the Occupy movement or some other aspect of movements of the 99%, I think people are going to, regardless of what happens to any particular set of organizing, people are just going to stay active until that's handled. And I can give you some update of what's happening around the country if you like.
Please,
you
know, do.
Well, I think New York, I should start with L.A. because Los Angeles was the Occupy group that actually put the call out and said, we want to have a May Day. L.A. is, of course, where they instigated the really big immigrant rights marches back in 2006. And they're having a march right now that's coming from the four directions, from four different parts of Los Angeles. They were picketing at the airport in conjunction with the union out there. There was stories about it slowing down the actual operation of the airport. We haven't been able to confirm whether that indeed happened or not, but we do know that there's marches converging on the central part of Los Angeles from four different sides of the city of Los Angeles. And along the way, they're doing activities involving things like the foreclosure movement and immigrant rights. In Seattle, where I come from, I'm not there right now, but the reports I've heard from Seattle is that a small group of folks that I guess they believe that property damage is going to help make change, and they've been busting some windows. And I'm really disappointed to hear that, but they've been busting some windows at Nike Town and some of the banks. Chicago's having a big march, a couple thousand people out on the street. Chicago, of course, is getting ready for the big NATO summit that's coming up on May 20th, and there's people converging there then for that. But this is sort of a couple thousand people out on the streets, you know, in solidarity with what's going on elsewhere. New York City, I think, is one of the biggest locations. They've been doing, starting in Bryant Park in New York, they've been doing what your other guest just mentioned, having a free university. A bunch of students did a walkout and said, you know, we can educate ourselves. We don't need to be getting into $1 trillion of student debt. That's how much student debt there is right now. You know, it's $1 trillion. It's more than all the credit card debt combined. And students are just, you know, really up against it. If they try to get an education so they can get a good job, they're just finding themselves in way in debt. And then they come out of school, and instead of finding a job that will allow them to pay that debt off, they're finding very little or only low-wage jobs, and they're moving back in with their parents, and they just, you know, they're beside themselves. And I think a lot of those folks are the basis of the Occupy movement. They're also doing some things like having something they're calling a really, really free market, where people are bringing things and trading them and giving them away, and they're doing teach-ins. You know, they're sort of creating the kind of atmosphere, the kind of world we'd like to live in, where people give and take, and they share together, and they get to celebrate being together. And so it's not only marches, it's also just celebration of community.
Should we open the phones here? I'm curious what folks are thinking about this May Day, about the Occupy movement, what Sarah just talked about in terms of the $1 trillion debt that people have trying to go through college. I mean, that affects all of us. It affects you. If you're going to college now, it affects people who are my age and a little bit younger, even Lester's age, who had kids going to college. You have a daughter getting ready to go to college.
Oh, yeah, she
starts
in the fall.
Right?
Yep.
So what about that debt? How do you face it? What do you think we should be doing about that? 410-319-8888. And I'll read a little bit later in the program some reflections on the other thing we're talking about today, which is the 20th anniversary of the L.A. riots, and we call it the L.A. Rebellion took place in 2012. and 1992. This is 2012. We'll be reading some comments about that as well. So your thoughts on 410-319-8888. Let's go to Alex in Randallstown. You're on the air.
Mark, good afternoon. Once again, it's a great pleasure just to hear you discuss these awesome topics, and I appreciate all your guests for bringing this to light, for educating people, for raising concerns, and for motivating the energy around things that actually need to get done that are for the people, which some people turn on a TV and they don't know who the 99% are, believe it or not. You know, it's us. It's everyone. You know, the May Day party. I came from Soviet Union 25 years ago, and then to me, May Day is a very, you know, special holiday. Was celebrated throughout the Europe. It's celebrated. It's a party of a solidarity of the people, the sickle and the hammer. You know, people of the land, and then the people of the skill. And that is the 99%. That is not the, you know, stockbroker. That is not the banker. That is not the person that's buying the politicians to blow up the mountain of West Virginia. That's not who it is. It's us, and I'm glad that May Day is up, and I'm glad that people are learning about it. And I just wanted to voice about the bartering. Bartering is actually in the next decade. It's a huge movement. It's a worldwide movement, and people are trying to trade things and learn of creative ways to exchange services and feel as a community instead of feeling as a consumer having to pay into the debt. You know, that they're brought up like slaves by people that just, you know, buy politicians here and there. And those politicians blowing up our mountains and sucker punching people, you know, when they're trying to speak up. So I just want to say that with the whole planet moving into a different vibration, everybody that's on it is starting to wake up. And I'm grateful that shows like yours, you know, allow people access to the information, which boils them over and gives them no choice but to wake up and to stand up and say, hey, if somebody needs to do something about something, I am something. I am somebody, and I'm going to do something about it. And I think...
Alex? Oh, somehow we got disconnected. We didn't do that to you, Alex. Something disconnected on... Well, it wasn't us. But I appreciate the thoughts and comments. In response to Alex?
Yeah, he's right. I mean, the thing is... So stuff like this takes... You know, we talk about how change occurs and how do movements get started. And they get, there are a number of ways they get started, and we can't necessarily use social science to predict them. But what we do know is that it requires a certain type of creativity and a certain willingness, not just to critique, but to think about what something else might look like, and then to propose alternatives to that something else. Right. And it doesn't have to be. So there are a number of protests. But if you know, Sarah didn't just talk about protests and marches. There are also attempts to create. Right. So, again, you've got the bartering. You've got people who are bartering across the country. You've got the open air university stuff. There are a number of ways that people are actually getting together and saying, OK, what should labor mean for us? How do we make labor work for us? Like literally. Right,
Sarah.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And one of the teach-ins that I saw was going on in Brooklyn that I thought was really wonderful was a teach-in on how to start a worker co-op. So people are saying, you know, this economy just isn't really working out so well for us. An economy that's based on, you know, people working really hard, but all the benefits going to the top 1%. Well, let's start our own economy. Let's have worker cooperatives. In Yes Magazine, we cover that quite a bit. We look at, you know, how are people actually doing that? How are, for example, people who are domestic workers, how are they forming together and creating their own cooperative business so that they can train each other and they can keep the fruits of their labor themselves and share it among themselves and set it aside for their families and their retirement? So, yeah, I absolutely agree. And one of the things about Occupy as opposed to protest movements is that it's actually about creating the space for exactly what Lester was talking about, for people to be creative in real time, to try out what it means to have real democracy, where everybody's voice counts, where everybody is heard. You know, what does that feel like when your voice matters and when everybody will listen to you as well as to everybody else? What does it feel like to you know, mix it up and not just be with the people that you're at normally in your neighborhood or your workplace, but people, you know, for a student to come and sit down next to a guy who's been out on the street and homeless for the last 20 years and talk about what kind of world you want. You know, those kinds of things are really changing the whole political dynamic in our country, and I think it's really exciting.
And I add one thing.
Sure.
So today was my last day of class for the semester. So I taught American racial politics at the graduate level, and I taught class urban policy at the undergraduate level. And I told the students who did excellent like projects, and I told them, I said, as much as people may cast aspersions about cities like Baltimore, kind of like Rust Belt cities that are viewed as being quote unquote down on their luck or in some ways being third world cities, it's like the types of encounters we're talking about here, they can take place elsewhere, but they really take place in cities. Right. It's really the city that's the central geographic space in which these movements and these discussions and these alternatives are supposed to be developed. And that's something that I think we can lose sight of, but we shouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Let me return to the phones here. 410-319-8888. And Aaron, on the east side, you're on the air.
Well, first of all, this May Day, well, for me, is a good day because there's some pieces that our children got protected better this year with Delegate Carter's St. Felicia's Law, that when our children go missing, they'll be more protected now. And I think that's something that'll take a load out of working people who have children, that at least their children will be protected a little bit.
That was a good law, and she worked hard to make that happen.
Because our children, see, you can't work and be a part of this workforce if you're worried about whether your children are safe.
Aaron, it's always good to hear from you, and I appreciate that thought. And I think that Jill Carter is one of those folks who fights really hard in the state legislature for working-class rights, and I think that I'm glad you brought her name up. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Mike, you're on the air.
Good evening, folks.
Hi, Mike. Welcome.
Where the hell am I going to begin?
Uh-oh.
Yeah,
watch it now. Boy. This is public radio. You've got to watch it.
Oh, where in Hades will I begin? I'm sorry. I forgot what a moral country this is. But thank you for reminding me. Okay, here's the deal. I want to talk about the so-called vision thing that Dr. Spence brought up. We have to have a sense of where we're going. There's no question about that. If you don't have a sense of where you're going, then you're not going anywhere. It's that simple. Well, the other thing, to have that sense of where you're going, I think a part of it, a basis of it, is to know why you have to move. And I think right now, we, and I mean the people of this planet, are under attack. This capitalist system, they call it globalization. Well, it, on the one hand, it's knocked down the barriers between the countries of the world and created a real basis for unity. At the same time, this fight has so many damn faces. It's not just the U.S. and it's not just Occupy, although right now that's an extremely important manifestation of this world process. But the migrants were forced to cross borders in search of work to feed their families. Those living on public aid or low-wage jobs, those who are homeless, unemployed, and those who are losing their homes to the bankers, the so-called 1% now. These are just a few of the categories of people around the world that we have to unite and create a bright future. But we have to fight for it.
Mike, thank you. Thank you so much. Sarah, comment on what Mike was saying?
Well, yeah, I think that is actually what's happening today on May Day. Is I think there are people out on the streets, and they're in fact engaged in that exact battle. It has that great combination of saying no to Bank of America and no to Wells Fargo, but it's also saying yes. What kind of world do we want to create? And you know, we're going to go about creating it. Going back to the globalization question, I think that's a really important point. And I think we've just seen the movement forward of this Colombia Free Trade Agreement. And I think one of the things, we were just talking about NAFTA here at Free Speech TV. We're talking about NAFTA and the way it helped to dislodge a lot of people from their livelihoods, because the traditional communal ownership system was upended by NAFTA. The dumping of corn into the Mexican market, put a lot of farmers out of business, and that helped to create a whole lot of people who had to leave home and look for work somewhere else, and some of them came to the United States. So, yeah, the whole free trade, the whole globalization thing has really been about a war against the 99%, you know, the small farmers, the small business people, the workers. Basically, everyone loses under that system because all the wealth and all the economic prosperity is going to the 1%. So I agree. I think we need to be looking at what kind of economic system we want to create that actually keeps the wealth of our country, which is really made up of, you know, the smarts of ordinary people and our beautiful natural inheritance in our cities. That's the real wealth of our communities and in our country, and we need to keep that wealth circulating among all of us.
And there's something else he said. He used the term manifestation when he talked about Occupy. He noted that it wasn't a matter that Occupy was just one of many manifestations. That's important to understand as well, because Occupy is getting, and deservedly so, a lot of press, but it isn't the only actor. And people who are listening and who want to find a way to kind of wrestle with this should not think of it as the only actor, right? It's about creating as many different manifestations of this process as we can possibly fit in a given space to see exactly what takes, because we don't know at any given point in time, we don't know what's going to take and what isn't, right? We really don't. That's why we need as many different movements, as many different people, different types of people acting, all towards the, you know, as many different types of ideas, all moving towards kind of sort of figuring out through dialogue and through, and sometimes through conflict, what this new thing is going to look like.
And that is a big piece of where we are right now. We're just trying to kind of find the place. And I think that this is a very different time. And these movements across the globe are defining what they want from society in very different ways. Whether it's what goes on in Spain today or in Greece today or in Athens today or even in throughout the subcontinent of Africa, where people are standing up for their rights and saying we're not going to allow this to be jailed and not allow us to be oppressed. And I think that these are this is all connected in ways that they have not been before emotionally in many ways. I think that it's like the underside of globalization.
Yes, yes, that's it.
You know,
that's it.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's so important is that there, you know, for many years there's been lots of different social movements going on, but there's a convergence now. There's that, you know, the many different kinds of things happening that you were talking about, Lester. But there's also, I think, a convergence around some values, and those values are that we need a world and we need an economy that works for everyone, that we can't leave anybody out, that we can't allow Wall Street and the big oligarchs to run our lives for us. We need real democracy. You know, so as diverse as all those movements are, it's really great to see them kind of converging around some of these same goals and values. And that gives me a lot of hope that together we can really work together and that we can really have some power.
You know, I was thinking about and how universal is what I was trying to think about and couldn't just get out of my mouth was what happened in Uganda, where one of the leading activists was arrested, and the police groped and grabbed her breast and pulled her out, and she went and actually grabbed the officer's testicles and returned, and they took her in. But then all these hundreds of women came to the streets. And so this is happening across the globe. The movements are bubbling up from people demanding human rights and workers' rights and rights and economic rights. It really is universal, and we're not covering it as a universal.
And that Uganda case is important. If this is the one I'm thinking about,
Ingrid Turinawe.
Yeah, where it's deeply authoritarian. They have a regime that is far harder on their citizens than the U.S. is. But what they were able to do was creatively deploy labor. So what they decided to do is all of them decided just to walk to work, right? Everybody decided to walk to work. And just the simple act of them deciding to walk to work end up shutting the country down. Right. And they were able to. It was creative. It was innovative. It was nonviolent. And it was something that Uganda could not, that the Ugandan government could not respond to. Right. So it's about being creative. It is about those about establishing those values and affirming what this new world looks like.
We're going to take a very brief break. And we come back from this break, we're going to go to Clarence, our next caller up at 410-319-8888, hear his thoughts. We're going to reflect a little bit on the L.A. rebellion that happened 20 years ago. How does that tie into what's happening today? How does the beating that launched that rebellion tie into Trayvon Martin and many other things, and how that all ties into what we're talking about today? Stay with us as we talk with Dr. Lester Spence and Sarah Van Gelder from Yes Magazine. Don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back to you in the end, and you have a say. www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. We are here with Sarah Van Gelder, executive editor of Yes Magazine. And Lester Spence, Dr. Lester Spence, assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University and author of the book Stare in the Darkness, Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. 410-319-8888 is the number. A couple things we want to jump into, but first I said we go right to the phones. I want Lester then to talk about the meeting taking place around Occupy and Homes that's taking place this week, and we'll take a look at the L.A. Rebellion and 20 years later and what that how that fits into all of this. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, good evening, Mr. Steiner and Mr.
Welcome.
Dr. Spence. I don't think anybody expressed it more clearly than down on St. Paul Street at Red Emma's, the bookstore and coffee shop. They had a banner in the window about 8 foot long that said 2012, a globe in revolt. And it just, every time I went past, it just captured my, you know, it expressed
yeah.
it. Very clearly. I don't know why they took it down, because it's, you know, maybe the government, you know, somebody said something to them, but it expressed exactly more clearly than anything else I've seen. Mr. Spence, I had a thought the other day that there is no distinction now, in my mind, from the government, from democracy and capitalism. You know, it's like that equation has been flipped upside down, with where capitalism was the economic system that operated in democracy. And when you look at it now, there's no clear line there. It's almost like capitalism is our government. So, you know, if you would comment on that statement, how would you feel about that? Thank you.
Oh, thanks for your comment. I agree. And I go a bit further, right? It's like not just. So part of this neoliberal turn is what happens is the market infects not just our government, but it infects our schools, it infects our churches, right? It affects a number of other institutions, right? So even it was funny. I was watching Melissa Harris Perry's show. It's absolutely brilliant, and I don't just say that because I consider Melissa a friend. But they were talking about Obama and Congress people being hired and fired. Right. So when it's like our elected representatives, our political representatives are elected. They aren't hired or fired. Right. So it's even in our language where you see that type of thing colonizing, where you see capitalism in the market. They're colonizing all these spaces that it shouldn't be. And it's deeply problematic for us. That's actually the fight. The I talked about in my urban policy class how our fight is really that our fight is about the city, but our fight is really about decoupling democracy from capitalism. It's about creating this democracy that, when America's at her best, and it doesn't happen that often to be fair, but you know, that creating a democracy that used to the best of American ideals. That's what it's about.
Sarah, how would you play on that?
I think that analysis is just right. I think in the corporate media, they often conflate the two, and some politicians do that too. They say, you know, we're trying to spread democracy around the world, when what they're really meaning is we're trying to spread corporate capitalism around the world and give our the corporations that have hired and fired us the most access to the rest of the world's resources and cheap labor. You know, so I think it is really important to get really clear on that. You know, my own view is that I'm really pro-democracy. I believe that, you know, that people ought to have power over their communities and over their country, and I'm pretty passionate about that. But I am not, I don't feel the same way about the role that our big corporations are having around the world. So I do think it's important to make that distinction.
This is also, right on this point, the 20th anniversary of what erupted in L.A. When four white officers who were caught on videotape bludgeoning a drunk driver, whose name was Rodney King, and beating him severely, and were let off, it created a rebellion in those streets. 54 people died. Some $1 billion worth of damage was done. You know, there was the horrible beating of Reginald Denny that took place as well, and it was interesting. His response was a completely non-racist response to his beating, but that took place there as well. And we did a number of shows months after that when we first went on the air in 1993, talking with many people in L.A. who had been there and been part of it and lived through it. And so that was 20 years ago. And now we see, is there a connection here in some ways between that and the shooting of Trayvon Martin, with, you know, when we look at things that happen in America, whether it's Trayvon Martin or what happened in General Louisiana or in Tulia, Texas, or Amadou Diallo or Abdul Nouima, and how people react to it, especially many people, not all, but many people in the white world outside of people on the left and some liberals who didn't react to it in terms of seeing connections between this and what happens in America around race. And so what that time says to us now, in the midst now of this new Occupy movement, and what that, starting with you, Les, and then we'll go to Sarah Van Gelder, what this connection means to you, if anything.
So there's another connection that I haven't seen that many people make, where at the same time that the decision comes down and the rebellion starts, the Cosby Show ends. It ends its run. And Bill Cosby actually goes on the air in the L.A. market trying to convince L.A. residents to stay at home and watch his show, as opposed to going on going outside and causing havoc. I bring up that moment because the Cosby Show was kind of the first modern attempt to bring this upper middle class black family into the public gaze,
right.
And in some ways you can draw a straight line between the Obamas, and, you know, both of whom were trained at Harvard, and Bill Cosby. So one of the things I talk every time I get on the show, what I talk about is not just the racial issues, but the class issues, right? So what 20 years later, what I think that we have to fight is, within black communities, we have to fight this significant I don't want to say class war, but it's like class warfare is already occurring. And what we have to do, particularly when we're dealing with this labor question or dealing with policing issues, is figure out how we can actually create space for this black population that many black people feel disgust and derision towards, not just whites. Right. So that's the thing that's really become is really complicated this particular moment.
That's very interesting. Sarah?
Yeah, you know, I think the Trayvon Martin situation certainly, you know, would upset any views that we are in a post-racial society, because it is so clear that there is just, you know, that this was just one of these horrific incidences which were clearly associated with racial motivation, you know, if not on the part of the shooter, I'd certainly on the part of his supporters, and on the part of the people who are putting these stand your ground laws into effect. And you know, just to connect it to the Occupy movement, I think one of the things that's happening is that there's, you know, that as working class and poor folks are confronting the situation that they're in, traditionally in our country, one of the ways that the powers that be have kept us divided is to keep us divided along racial lines. And it's often been black-white, although it's also been, you know, anti-Irish, anti-Italian, anti-Chinese, you know, but it keeps us divided. And, you know, and unfortunately, there's an awful lot of folks who are just ready to play into that and to, you know, instead of saying, we need a system where we can all thrive, they get scared or they get, you know, mean, and they say, well, I'm going to thrive, I'm going to do better if my race can, you know, we white people can maintain the privilege that we've had up to now. So I think, you know, one of the things that I'm really glad to see about in all of these movements is that there's a really strong, all these social movements, there's a really strong anti-racial, racist element to it. And I think there's a very clear understanding that we can't have any real progress in this country until we have a society that works for everyone, and that means nobody's left out.
And how do you see that playing out here, Lester, just in Baltimore? I mean, you were...
Yeah. So... I've been doing work with people who are involved with Occupy, and you know, because of the winter, you know, Occupy Baltimore kind of was they were kind of it's not that they weren't what they were doing, they were under the radar. But one of the things that a number of people have talked about since Occupy Baltimore was at McKeldin Square was this foreclosure crisis as it relates to issues of labor, to issues of race and class, and safety, as one of the first callers mentioned. So on this Thursday, Occupy Our Homes, which is kind of a spinoff, is going to be having an event at St. Ambrose's Roman Catholic Church, 4502 Park Heights, with the Public Justice Center and the Civil Justice Center to have a discussion with kind of tenants and homeowners who are facing or feel as if they may be facing foreclosure or foreclosure-related ills. So I'm actually going to be there talking about, you know, because I've had my own challenges with this issue. Right. I'm going to be there talking about this stuff. And again, it's about creating voice or creating room for voice. So part of it is just the conversations about what another world looks like. But the other part of it is just public conversations about where we are and understanding that a lot of the private stuff that we're going through is the product of public decisions, right? So it's about kind of publicizing our own private stuff in a way that's healing and also in a way that points us to movement and political action.
Sarah, before I jump to Calvin, our next caller up, then Terrence, what you just heard Lester Spence describe, how do you see that playing itself out across the country? Do you see the movements across the country as being these movements that kind of deal with issues of poverty and poor people and working people and also the ones that cross lines of race and ethnicity? How are you viewing them since you have said this overview of what's happening in America?
Well, I think one of the most important things that came out of Occupy is breaking down the division between middle-class people and poor people. It isn't to say that division has been completely broken down, but a lot of middle-class people can no longer say, you know, if you're poor, it's your own fault, because they're facing poverty themselves. They're facing economic challenges.
Yeah.
So I think that division is really breaking down, which is a really great thing. And in terms of the housing situation, you know, I think one of the things that's really clear is that for many, many people, and this is particularly true of people of color, you know, the main asset that they were able to build in their lives has been their home. And so people of color have lost a tremendous proportion of their family assets in this housing crunch. So I think it's an incredibly important part of the movement that people are saying, you know, this is just not okay. They're occupying homes. They're insisting that banks renegotiate loans. They're taking them, you know, taking seriously the illegality of the robo-signing scandal and all the other ways that Wall Street thought that they could slice and dice mortgages and then still collect on them, even though they can't produce the paperwork to say who actually owns the homes anymore.
Right.
You know, they'll get all self-righteous about property rights, but when they can't actually establish them, they still expect to be able to exercise, you know, and they still expect to be able to get the full value of the house, even though everyone knows that those old housing values were bubble values. So, you know, I think that the foreclosure movement, the anti-foreclosure movement, is a really important part of the time we're in.
Sarah Van Gelder is executive editor of Yes Magazine. Dr. Lester Spence, assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, who wrote the book Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. We'll come to these calls coming in now. And we're reflecting on this May 1st, what it means as a holiday, what's going on with the Occupy movement, and the 20 years since the L.A. Rebellion. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Calvin, you're on the air.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, I just wanted to touch on what you guys have been talking about. I feel like a question that could be asked or should be asked to start the conversation is, how can we use capitalism for democracy instead of what we have now, which is capitalism using democracy? What I mean when I say that is example of capitalism using democracy would be something like what you see with the bailout, big banks getting bailed out, or the person, corporate personhood, where the corporations can pretty much buy the legislative, buy a mayor or politician, excuse me. Mm-hmm. But the idea behind a democracy using capitalism would be something more like focusing on local economies, or public banks, or free education, things of that nature. You know, getting away from, and going back to some of the points you were just talking about, getting away from concentration of poverty, where you have a lot of crime and basically a lack of resources. So basically, I just wanted to say that, you know, I feel like the conversation should be centered around the question, how do we get democracy to use capitalism instead of capitalism using democracy?
That's a really good thought, and I'm glad you said. So let me start again with Sarah, because, I mean, Sarah, in some ways, there's one of the many subtexts that runs through Yes Magazine. It feels like he's finding a new way to think.
That's right.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And, Calvin, I love that way of thinking about it, and I completely agree with you that we can recreate the kind of economy that we want from the bottom up instead of letting the big corporations define our economy. And, you know, just in terms of semantics, I usually think of capitalism as being the rule by the big corporations and Wall Street, and I usually think of the market economy as being more about the local economy and being, you know, and we talk a lot about how to build local living economies at Yes Magazine, which is, you know, the kind of thing that you were talking about. And to connect that to the housing crisis, Yes Magazine has just went to press with an issue on housing. And so an example of how do we bring housing home? How do we get housing out of that speculative market where you know, Wall Street bankers are using our mortgages as something to bet on? And, you know, we all know what it's like when you go in a casino, you know, the house always wins. And it's the same thing when we have our housing in the global casino, is that the big guys are always going to win and we are going to lose. So how do we get housing out of that speculative market altogether and start bringing our mortgages back to little community banks and credit unions where we can trust that the bankers are going to know what they're doing, that they're working in our best interests? And how do we make those banks and credit unions really democratic? How do we, you know, how can we elect the board of directors for those local institutions so they're rechanneling our resources, the money that's in the bank from our communities back into the community? Another example that we looked at a lot is community land trusts, where the community owns the land and then gives long-term leases to folks to occupy the homes on that land. And, you know, when you look around at community land trusts, they've had less than a tenth of the foreclosure rate as the private market. And it's a lot of low and moderate-income folks that are living in those houses. So they work with people to – it's all about keeping people in their homes and keeping people in decent and affordable housing, instead of about, you know, how do we find a way to, you know, use lending as a predatory means to extract a whole lot of wealth out of poor folks.
Yeah, along the same lines. So if we jump to an issue like college education, I actually wrote a piece about this. It would cost approximately $30 billion a year to educate, to pay for the public education of every student who is qualified to go to a public college like University of Maryland College Park, right? Only $30 billion a year. Now, maybe $30 billion sounds like a lot of money, But compared to the tax cuts that the Republicans passed, compared to the money that's already been spent in Afghanistan and Iraq, compared to the money that's been spent in a whole wide range of issues that we disagree with as a public, $30 billion isn't a lot of money, right? So it's about figuring out ways to use the revenue that we're generating in service of the public. You know, to use a more local example, you talk about a number of people are starting to come back to the idea of gardening. You have urban gardens started in places like Baltimore and Detroit and Milwaukee, and they're connecting those urban gardens with grocery stores, with restaurants. It's about the market exists. Right. The market exists. But how can we use that for the public? And people are already doing it. It's just about taking the ideas, publicizing them, and then in some cases forcing people to engage with them.
I mean, it's almost as if you took the ideas we just talked about here. This thing, things you, I can't wait for this issue to come out, Sarah. And when it does, we'll do a series of shows on some of the articles that came out. Because I think that what has to happen is you have to begin to engage communities and conversations about how things happen in other parts of the country, where people are doing things that are different, and how to create a force in a community that begins to demand that change here.
Yeah.
You know, and to wherever this land trust idea is really being worked on, how do you translate that to Baltimore? How do you translate that to Newark, to Detroit, or whatever the other cities are?
Absolutely. Great conversation.
And so that would be, I mean, that's part of what is kind of.
Sorry,
go ahead, Lester.
So I'll give you an example of how that. So this works for us already, but I'll give you an example of how it works on the other side. One of my students, one of my student groups for urban policy, they did a story on the broken windows theory, right? The idea that the best way to deal with crime is to really tamp down on minor order infractions in a community. This idea started in an Atlantic Monthly article published in the mid-80s. It wasn't something that had been even peer-reviewed. It was the guy who proposed it, James Q. Wilson, who passed away recently.
Right.
He wasn't even like, listen, this isn't something I really thought had teeth, right? But people glommed onto it. Next thing you know, you had broken windows policies in New York City, in Baltimore, in LA. Every major city was deploying this, usually to disastrous results.
Right.
So this dynamic that we're talking about is already occurring. It's just about us doing it again through magazines like Yes, through and The Nation and the like, through entities like WEAA, through the Mark Steiner Show, through RealNews.com, through Free Speech TV, through a number of different venues. I mean, the stuff is already there. And it's not, and in fact, it's not just national. It's also about borrowing global ideas, like the concept of participatory budgeting that some cities have begun to deploy. That starts in South America.
So this has really been a fascinating conversation to have with our guests. And I Sarah Van Gelder, I appreciate you joining us here at the very last second, almost, when we called out today to be part of this conversation, executive editor of Yes Magazine and an occasional partner with us and with programs that we do. And Sarah, thank you so much once again for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Mark, and great to meet you, Dr. Spencer.
Great to meet you, too. We really appreciate your work. Great work.
And Lester Spence, before we leave out of here, I want to thank you again once again for always being willing to come here. Want to announce that one more time?
Yeah, this Thursday at 7:00, 4502 Park Heights, Occupy Our Homes is working with the Public Justice Center and the Civil Justice Center for both tenants and homeowners who are dealing with the foreclosure crisis in one way or another. Please come and share your stories with me. I'll be there.
So we'll check that out as well. And this is May Day. It is International Labor Day. And Workers' Day, and I want to remember Jane, again, Lucy Parsons, African-American woman, former slave who had led that struggle in the 19th century, who would always forget. She thought about Occupy before it happened when she said we have to stop doing strikes as we used to, and her conception of strikes in the future, she said, in the 1880s, is not to strike and go out to starve, but to strike and remain and take possession of the necessary property of production in our communities. And she talked about that in the 1880s. So, Lucy Parsons, you are the great-grandmother of Occupy. So we remember you here on this Labor Day who came out of slavery in Texas. I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Number is 1-800-638-7781. and made possible by the University of Maryland's Inflammatory Bowel Disease Program, a multidisciplinary care service dedicated to relieving symptoms and improving the quality of life of IBD patients. More information is available at 1-800-492-5538. And, of course, Urbanite Magazine is our local print partner here, and we invite you to Urbanite's Healthy Film Food Series, part of the 2012 Urbanite Project, continues this weekend. The second movie is Urban Roots, covers the growing urban farming movement in Detroit, and will be screened at the 2640 space on St. Paul, this Friday, May 4th at 6 p.m. Find out more at urbaniteproject.com. The Mark Steiner Show is the production, the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Cricket Aronson and Justin Levy. Our assistant producer is Cassandra Monsanto. Our interns are Alex Pearson, Alexis Seth, and Tiffany Means, who are engineered by Regis Tucker. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To podcast any of our past shows and find out information about our guests and their work, please join us at steinershow.org. And it's Wealthy Lifestyles coming up. Both Mr. and Mrs. Owens in the house at the same time. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.